The Playlist with Ben and Fiona.
It is a drama which provokes discussion around sex positivity.
Welcome to The Playlist, where we talk about movies and TV shows that are worth your time. I'm Fiona Williams, and I'm joined by my co-host, Ben Nguyen. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Fee, it's great to be back.
I know, it's been a little while. We've got a little quiet.
Yeah, which means we've got a lot to talk about.
Yeah,
this week we're talking about the new Tarantino flick, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and what we've been watching, SBS local drama, The Hunting, and some of the highlights from the Melbourne International Film Festival, which I think just goes to show you've had a busy last few weeks, Fee.
It's been a little nuts, yeah. With The Handmaid's Tale wrapping up, and with it, my other podcast, Eyes on Gilead. Yeah, there's been a lot else I've been watching, but now that's all done and dusted, boohoo. Yeah, back into playlist mode.
Well, I think that that prompts the question, what do you do when a show that means a lot to you comes to an end for another year? How does that leave you as a viewer?
I don't know. It's literally just finished up, so, well, I'm waiting for the book, frankly, The Testaments. That's my next Handmaid's Universe kind of big bite.
Something to look forward to before the next season.
It's true. That'll tide me over. Hopefully. Not going to rewatch Handmaids, I don't think. Yeah, I've watched that several times over each episode. But got to find a new obsession, I think.
Oh, well, perhaps it could be the new movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Smooth.
It's 1969. Leading man Rick Dalton, Leonardo DiCaprio.
I'm Rick Dalton.
Has come from a hit Western TV series to star in movies. But that well has run dry and is jobbing as villain of the week in a string of TV shows.
It's official, old buddy. Well, has been.
He spends his time hanging out with his stunt double buddy Cliff Booth, Brad Pitt.
Me an actor?
No, I'm a stuntman.
Who also doubles as his driver and hired help.
You're Rick fucking Dalton. Don't you forget it.
Meanwhile in Hollywood, Roman Polanski and his actress wife Sharon Tate, Margot Robbie.
I'm Sharon Tate. I'm in the movie.
Have moved into the house next door, and a certain hippie family have moved into the old ranch set with murder on their mind. Fee, are you more of a Leo or Brad person?
That's your question coming out of it. Well, if I had to choose, like, Brad, I think he's more versatile as an actor. I'm not entirely Team Leo, I have to say.
How did you find him in this?
Well, I think he was playing a version of himself, sort of at the height, the peak of his powers, but also coming off the peak of his powers, trying to work out the next role. It's a self-aware role, I think, so it's worked for me.
Yeah, a very self-aware movie, very much a movie about the making of movies.
Yep, absolutely. So, of course, Quentin Tarantino does this in all his movies, but particularly here when it's about Hollywood, it's a fairy tale about Hollywood. He goes deep with references and there's nods to various movies that would go over most people's heads. And, there's a lot that are obvious, but he goes very deep with this.
Yeah, I don't know that I'm as good at spotting those references as you. There's a lot of really fantastic clips from the movies that Leo's character stars in the show. And I was curious, do you know if some of that, is that using real movie footage or was that all created for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Yeah, I'm not actually sure on that. I feel like he's been inserted in some of them, in the TV shows especially. But other than the Leo stuff, like Margot Robbie is of course playing Sharon Tate.
Yeah.
And there's a wonderful sequence where she goes and watches The Wrecking Crew, Sharon Tate movie, and Tarantino actually uses the real movie. He doesn't put Margot Robbie in it, which she's watching Sharon Tate, but she's playing Sharon Tate watching herself.
Yeah,
which is wonderful.
Yeah, really interesting, given that she is playing a real person.
Yes.
And we should say that the movie does deal with some real events that occurred in 1969, and we're going to avoid any spoilers because it does sort of deal with that history in its own way.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's a tricky one to talk about if you haven't seen the film, and we're going to do our darndest to not wreck it because I think it is all in the revelation of watching it, so bear with us.
Yeah.
There may be some gymnastics that we have to try here, but we'll give it a go. Give it a red hot go.
But I did think that that was a beautiful moment. So Margot Robbie playing Sharon Tate, and she just finds a suburban cinema. She's still, you know, fairly new in her career, and she just walks up to the ticket booth and has to sort of gradually convince the staff there that she actually is the movie star that is in the movie that they're showing.
Yep.
And then she wants to do that thing, which is sneak into a suburban cinema and experience what the movie is like with an audience. And that it really is a joyful moment.
It's wonderful. Yeah.
It is a real celebration of Sharon Tate, this movie.
Yep.
Even though Margot Robbie gets very few lines.
Ugh. Well, we need to talk about this. Yeah. I think so. This film opens after months of speculation, pre-release outrage, think pieces for days about how many lines Margot Robbie has in comparison to her male co-stars.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's a valid point about the representation of women on screen, of course.
Yeah.
But it's void when you watch this film because it's... She doesn't have a lot of lines because she's mostly alone. Like the scenes she's in, she doesn't even talk to. And she's watching a movie. So happily, she doesn't talk in the movies.
Yeah.
So it's a wider point to be had about movies in general and mostly the men who make the movies. But, I don't think it's relevant here at all.
Yeah.
Having seen the film now.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's an interesting choice the way that her screen time is used. Mm. And I think a valid choice because it's sort of trying to evoke, you know, her just a joyful, free spirit.
Mm.
And because for those who know about the Charles Manson murders, you know, that's something important in terms of just building up the threat and the jeopardy of, you know, what we know occurred with Sharon Tate.
Mm-hmm. These infamous murders that ended the free love ideas of the 60s, really, like Joan Didion was famous for saying that, like this was the moment that the 60s kind of flipped. That's not the direct quote. So, yeah, I think this film celebrates her life and her energy and, yeah.
Yeah, and that cinema scene really captures that. And yeah. I think the fact that we get to see the real Sharon Tate in those movie clips.
Mm.
I think that the end of an era is sort of throughout this movie and with the Rick Dalton character, we get a sense of that, you know, his television career petered out and to some degree his movie career is petered out. And it is sort of capturing in some ways what happened to the Western genre, both on TV and in cinema.
Mm-hmm.
And so we also see his character eventually agree to go over to Rome and start working on spaghetti Westerns.
Mm-hmm.
It's a celebration of the Western through different forms that it's taken on the screen as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure, yeah. And it's a buddy story, Leo and Brad, you know, Rick and Cliff, their dynamic. So it is, of course, their film. The story centres around them and it's a very long film, we need to say as well.
Yeah.
But when you think back about it, actually, yeah, it's only over a couple of days and then it jumps about 6 months ahead.
Yeah.
It's just them palling about, Rick trying to shore up his next gig because, yeah, as you say, his career is a little shaky. He's not 100% certain on where his next role is going to come from.
Well, the buddy comedy, I think, is a sort of, again, a favourite for Tarantino.
Mm.
I would say, though, I didn't feel like there was the same wit and wordplay in this screenplay that I'm used to from Tarantino.
Yeah.
So even though I enjoyed the rapport between Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio's character, yeah, I don't think sort of this was as witty a screenplay. Even, you know, his last film, The Hateful Eight, which almost plays out like a play in a single location and I think was much more reliant on language.
Yes.
Whereas this, I guess sort of you would say that this is a much more visual film.
For sure. Yeah. And it rambles and they amble around.
Yeah.
You know, Brad as Cliff does a lot of driving across LA and meets all various characters who will have various amounts of prominence.
I think it's fair to say that you could give this film some serious trims and not lose anything.
I agree. I think it plays with the length as well intentionally, but that doesn't mean I'm there for all of it. I had strange feelings coming out of this. I appreciate it, but I didn't leave thinking that was amazing. So, like, I have actually thought about it a lot since. It's popped into my head, so I think it's good.
Yeah.
But I wasn't, you know, punching the air as I walked out saying, wow, that was amazing, whereas other people I saw it with were, but much like the Margot Robbie scene where she's watching the movie with the crowd, I think this film benefits from watching it with a crowd.
Mm.
And I think that's Tarantino's intention, of course, being an advocate for watching movies in cinemas. And it's fascinating to watch the crowd react at certain moments with this, certain scenes. And here I go trying to not tiptoe around certain things. But, yeah, at what point people's reactions diverge a bit? Like something's funny and then, oh, wow, actually it's really not.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw it with a big audience last night in just, you know, big kind of multiplex cinema. And I think this movie's getting big audiences.
It is.
And that was fun. I think I know what scene you're talking about later on in the film, but also the scene where Brad Pitt has a backstage fight with Bruce Lee.
Yes.
Got a big audience reaction.
Yeah, right.
I am not convinced that Brad Pitt would beat the real Bruce Lee. I'm just throwing that out there.
Same. Yeah. Bruce doesn't come off looking all that great in that. And Tarantino has said it's, you know, he was famously arrogant, so he's sort of just putting that there to let the record reflect.
And I think you can see, like, it serves a role within the narrative of the film that we need to establish that Brad Pitt's character is actually, like, damn good at taking care of himself, and that's going to sort of play out in various situations.
Yes.
There's a number of TV actors playing cameos in this movie, which I felt was a little self-indulgent. So the late Luke Perry is in there.
Yeah.
Timothy Oliphant. There's Damian Lewis plays Steve McQueen.
He sure does. Yes. Yes.
So Tarantino's doing his old trick of throwing in some fave actors.
Yeah, and of course Kurt Russell and Zoe Bell are in it as well. There's a weird voiceover from Kurt Russell that comes in late in the film that I don't know why. Not sure.
I mean, I think there's a level of self-indulgence, but, you know, I feel like you forgive that because it's as much about reveling in cinema and, you know, like as movie fans, I think we can share in that.
Yeah.
I'm curious what you think. I do feel a little bit now that Leonardo DiCaprio, just sort of going back to his performance and he's become so associated with Martin Scorsese and Margot Robbie also, that I almost feel like there's an interchangeability between, I feel like Scorsese could have almost directed this and Tarantino could have almost directed Wolf of Wall Street. I don't know if you agree with that.
I would have liked to have seen what Scorsese would do with this. I love Wolf of Wall Street. I thought it was
wild. It too. Yeah.
No, I think that was great. So no. Goodfellas as well. I love that film and the way it uses its length as well and set up a scene and a cast, like an ensemble of characters, etc. I could see some of that applied to this that I would probably be more on board for. Yeah, interesting. I don't know.
I think that there's an energy that I think both those directors at this point in their career seem to be sharing. And I think sort of it's probably inseparable from the cast, the casting. And Leo, I think, is at a point in his career where he is like a very charismatic actor on screen, but he's got his toolkit and he milks them, those kind of intense stares and, you know, the bead of sweat dripping down his brow. And, you know, we've sort of come to expect that from Leo. Yeah. And I think that you said this before, but I think Brad Pitt in some ways gives a more enjoyable performance here because I think, you know, he's a bit looser and I think he's an actor more prepared to surprise us.
Yeah, totally. Like Wolf of Wall Street. Yeah, I love, but also I don't think that's a stretch for Leo to play that kind of character, let's be real, because I'm never fully convinced that he's disappearing into a role. Like it's always Leo playing a pioneer in The Revenant, which I love that film, but I was never – he never disappeared into the role for me. It was always Leo there. So when all that Oscar buzz of like when will Leo finally get his Oscar,
yeah,
I thought he can wait a while, yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah, whereas Brad, I can see him disappear into roles. But mind you, here he's just kind of charmed for days being, you know, just Brad hanging around and he's looking, you know, looking gorgeous.
Yeah. I think you could almost do a tally in this movie of the number of times that people put their boots or feet up on a chair or dashboard or there's a lot of leaning back and just sort of enjoying the LA sunshine.
Yes, exactly. And being a Tarantino film set in a time where it's possible to put some tracks down because he's made a couple of period films, Django and Hateful Eight didn't really offer much opportunity for putting Motown song in.
Yeah.
But here, it's funny, it's set in the late 60s. I'm struggling to actually remember the songs in it. That's sort of not standing out for me in this one, which is kind of funny.
Yeah,
for a Tarantino film.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely a jukebox element to the soundtrack. I mean, I was sort of enjoying the tunes, and it's definitely, you know, a lot of late 60s pop. There's Margot Robbie's character Sharon Tate is spinning a lot of records in the movie,
yeah,
and sort of getting down to those tunes. But I didn't think music served as big a role as some of his other films. I thought, like, it was a bit more backing track kind of just setting the tone of the period.
Mm.
I mean, I think that he was trying to stretch his, you know, musical muscles sort of rather than choosing some of the obvious takes. He would find the Motown cover, for example.
Yeah. I did interview him when he came out for Hateful Eight, and he was saying, you know, he was looking forward to making a film where someone could just put a tape in a tape deck for once rather than trying to, yeah, rather than a period thing. So
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is out now in cinemas. I think we managed to talk about it without covering much spoiler territory.
Yeah.
So you'll have to just show up at the cinema and have it spoiled for yourself.
By watching it. It's not spoiling it at all.
The best way to be spoiled. And now it's time for What Have You Been Watching? Sophie, what have you been watching? You've had a lot of time in front of cinema screens recently.
I have actually, yes. I was down for about half of the Melbourne International Film Festival, so got to see some excellent films. I'll run through a couple of them. I saw too many to mention here. That's probably a separate episode if I went through all of them. But I caught The Australian Dream, the other Adam Goods documentary this year. This one has a presentation from Stan Grant, sort of written by Stan Grant, and it's more of an essay kind of film that takes Adam Goods's experience and story and sort of paints a bigger picture, sort of trying to weave it in relation to just all the troubles Australia has with race and with the First Nations people. So it's Adam Goods is in it, and he's actually talking about the experience of horrendous racism that made him leave the game. Yeah, it fills in the picture of what has happened since that is really touching. And I was at the opening night of MIFF where Adam Goods was in attendance. So that had it, you know, made it all the more powerful. And especially seeing some of the instances of the tweets and the terrible instances of booing. Very aware that he's also in the audience having watched this again, made for a pretty powerful experience. And, of course, it got a standing ovation. And importantly, he didn't speak. He didn't, you know, he didn't get up to talk about it and things like that. It wasn't that kind of moment, and no one expected him to. But, yes, watching that in an audience where you're aware he's watching it too gave it an extra level.
Because I understand that it is in some ways based on the very powerful speech that Stan Grant gave about the Australian Dream and linking that to the experience of Adam Goods, but also his own experience and that of his family.
Yes. And other figures in sport. Yeah. There's a lot more to the story, but its lifting off point is Adam Goods' own experience. So it's an essay film really in that sense. So that kicked off MIFF. Other things I saw, just a random sampling I'll go through. My favourite film of the festival was Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which is not coming to cinemas till Boxing Day, but make sure you get there on Boxing Day. This one is the new one from Céline Sciamma, the French director. She did Tomboy a few years ago now. She did Girlhood, that wonderful film from a couple of years ago. This is a period film about a portrait painter who she's dispatched to paint the portrait of a mysterious woman who refuses to sit for painters because the purpose of the painting is to show her suitor, who's not met her, what she looks like. To, you know, she's got an arranged marriage going on. And that's a terrible shortcut attempt at a synopsis of what is a wonderful film and just the longing and the desire that comes out through these women painting and being painted and the longing glances. And it's just the most wonderful film. I loved it to bits. Can't wait to watch it again.
Fantastic. Let's talk more about it, hopefully, when it comes out.
Yes, exactly. You'll get a chance to see it too. And just one more that sort of speaks to my MIFF viewing experience. It's all about me. Cold Case Hammarskjöld. This one, there's a Danish journalist, Mads Brügger, who does these searing documentaries where he, you know, embeds himself in a story. He did The Ambassador, I think it's about 8 or 9 years ago now, where he was about the Central African Republic and he posed as an ambassador and exposed corruption. And yeah, it's incredible. And the risk he puts himself in by doing so. This one is Mads Brügger again, examining the case of the death of the United Nations Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld in the 60s in a plane crash that has always had a little bit of mystery around it. You know, who he was
conspiracy
involved. Love it. And And this one really goes deep in the weeds on this and explores all the threads of the story. And it's a wild ride. Amazing. And another one to see with an audience, because I just love, especially documentaries, watching them where it just takes all the various turns and the audience are with it. And
it's we're a great all united. Film festival experience.
Oh, it's the best. So yeah, that was a brilliant one. So hopefully that will get a release. I'm not sure if it's due to have one yet, but we'll definitely tell you if and when it does.
Exciting.
Yeah, good stuff. What have you been watching?
Well, the final episode of the SBS Australian drama, The Hunting, airs this week, and then all four episodes will be up on SBS On Demand for audiences to view. So this is what I've been watching. It's a drama set in South Australia, in Adelaide, between a couple of high schools, and it tells the story of some students who were sharing sexually explicit images between each other consensually, and then how what occurs when those get shared without their consent and the ripple effects from that. So it's, you know, a fantastic piece of Australian drama that tells that story through the prism of a few generations. So the students themselves, the young teachers who become involved, and the parents, notably Asha Keddie and Richard Roxburgh, do an excellent job of bringing a lot of complexity to parents of a child who is complicit in some of this image-based abuse. And there's a lot of issues of class and privilege that we see through their characters as well. But the cast is uniformly excellent, and it is a drama which provokes discussion around sexuality and sex positivity and toxic masculinity. All of this is embedded in the series. I think that there's some missteps that the show makes, which some of it is a consequence of having to tell this story compressed across 4 hours. There's some traps that the storytelling falls into a little bit, where there's the strict ethnic parent trope rears its head once again. There's a little bit of inauthenticity in some of the teenage interactions, where I think sort of hitting plot points has been prioritized over trying to capture authentic teenage behavior. But I really would recommend it, because I think Anna Kokkinos has directed the first two episodes, and she brings a real kind of style and vigor to those episodes. And and I think that, you know, it really is a strong piece of Australian drama.
And I think Sophie Hyde directs others as well.
Yeah.
No, I've been waiting to binge them all as a box set at On Demand, so I can't wait to sink my teeth into that one. Can you see teenagers watching this, or is it more from a parent's point of view? Who's your audience?
I think that the issues that it raises are so relevant to teenagers, but to be honest, I think that it's going to be difficult to get teenagers to this show. I think that there's an element of trying to explain these issues that I think that some teenagers might resent a little bit. But in terms of the sexually explicit content, I don't think that there's anything that, you know, a young person won't have already been exposed to in their own lives and on the internet. It has been made with parents in mind, and I think that's kind of where the value is really going to lie in terms of thinking about the issues that it raises.
I've seen some pieces on how to watch it with your kids, or how, you know, with your teenagers. Yeah, some maybe awkward co-viewing, but, you know, if you can manage it and have those conversations in your household afterwards, then that's probably not a bad thing in a mindful way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a really important conversation to be had about how much sending nudes is just actually like a very normal part of sexuality for young people. And it's just a reflection of how sexuality has moved into the ways that we communicate in a smartphone digital era. So I think that those conversations parents should ideally be having with their children. And I think it's important, you know, not to stigmatize the way that young people are relating to each other sexually, which the show, I think, sort of tries very hard to try and walk that fine line between demonstrating the risks without demonizing the behavior.
Mm. Well, I mean, it all hinges on trust and consent, and those are conversations you should be having absolutely with your teens.
Absolutely. So, yeah. I think consent and sex, I think, sort of just have to be very explicit parts of our conversations, both with young people, with you know, all sexually active adults.
Well, yeah.
I think, but it's, I guess, sort of the point I'm trying to make in a way is sort of how do we sort of treat this just as drama as opposed to sex education?
Of course, yeah, because that's the risk as well. Like, it sounds like.
And that's
like,
what I mean. That's sort of the element of turn off factor for a teenager, I think, is like, am I being just shown this, you know, in school as a piece of sex education?
Yeah. No, that's the thing. Like, yeah, it's a drama, first and foremost, but it, you know, it does tackle issues. So, yeah, that's the delicate line. You have to sort of not make it sound like hard work or something mortifying that you'd have to watch with your mum and dad. So,
But SBS has partnered with the eSafety Commissioner to give you some guidelines as parents as what you should be doing, so you can check that out.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess that.
Yeah. From the 60s to sexting. That's been a great episode, Fee. And everyone listening, make sure you subscribe to SBS The Playlist wherever you get your podcasts and give us lots of stars. Leave a nice review because it helps people find the show. If you want to get in touch, you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter at SBS Movies. And I'm on Twitter at Ben Nguyen TV.
I'm on Twitter at Anything But Fifi.
And The Playlist is produced by Jeremy Wilmot.
Till next time, thanks for listening.